KLOS and KLOS HD1, Los Angeles. This is the rock of Southern California. Now, shining a light on the people, organizations, and events that bring Southern Californians together. This is Spotlight on the Community with your host, Doug McIntyre.
We got tons of stuff to talk about, to say the least, including some big news from the United States Supreme Court. They made a ruling on offensive trademarks. And I'm very interested to see what our guest has to say about this. This was specifically related to the Asian American rock dance band called The Slants. The Trademark Commission would not issue the patent, and Trademark Office denied trademark protection to The Slants, saying that this was offensive. And the Supreme Court said it offends a bedrock First Amendment principle. Speech may not be banned on the ground that it expresses ideas that offend, said Samuel Alito. And this was a unanimous, this was an 8-0 decision. Joining us right now to talk about this and more, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show the dean of the School of Law at UC Irvine and author of the case against the Supreme Court, Erwin Chemerinsky. Good morning, Professor Chemerinsky. How are you?
Good morning. It's always wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you for coming on. Now, I took a stab in the dark and went out on a limb and earlier prophesied that you would support this ruling by the Supreme Court. Was I right or was I wrong?
I do. I think it's an easy case. One of the most basic principles of free speech law is that the government can't punish speech just because it's offensive, even deeply offensive. That's what the Supreme Court reaffirmed yesterday.
Yeah, well, I agree. I think that this was, and I think it's something that we really should celebrate, that with all the partisan divide and all the disagreement over some fundamental stuff, the Supreme Court, left and right, has been consistently supportive of First Amendment rights over many, many years, including flag burning being ruling that that is protected speech, which I also agree with. I think it's personally offensive, but it shouldn't be illegal. It's obviously a political statement. And I take some comfort that once again, the court managed to come up with the right ruling on this with great unanimity.
You're right. The result was unanimous. I think of it this way. Could you imagine if Congress passed a law saying no book, no song could be copyrighted if it had offensive lyrics or even if it used epithets? It would obviously be unconstitutional. And what the Supreme Court said yesterday is denying a trademark on the grounds that it's offensive is really no different.
Now, here's a question, because the ruling has been made, and now the question is, how does this ruling ripple into society? And since you are the dean of the UC Irvine School of Law, and you're right there on a major American campus, and it happens to be a state institution, a lot of colleges and universities have speech codes and, you know, free speech zones. You know, they've done all kinds of things to try to, exterminate offensive speech and provocative speech in some cases from college campuses. But would this eliminate that, especially at a state institution, since it is a state institution?
This case by itself doesn't speak to that. This is just about whether the Trademark Office can deny registration of a trademark on grounds of offense. But the underlying principles of free speech certainly apply to public college universities. I think they apply most to public college universities. If there's any place that should be a marketplace of ideas, it should be college universities. All ideas and views should be able to express there, no matter how offensive.
Well, I totally agree with that. And would you make the same argument at a private college?
Well, I would, but it's a different argument. The First Amendment and the Constitution apply only to the government. Private institutions don't have to comply with the First Amendment and the Constitution. But I believe the principles of academic freedom are the same, and I think private colleges and universities should do that. In California, in fact, there's a statute that says that private high schools and college universities cannot punish speech if it couldn't be punished at a public university. So in California, it is the case that private universities have to protect speech as well.
We're talking with Erin Chemerinsky, who is the dean of the School of Law at UC Irvine and the author of The Case Against the Supreme Court. Can I ask you, this isn't a legal opinion, but this is more of just observational from your perch at UC Irvine and your life experience. I'm old enough to remember when colleges and universities were citadels of free expression, certainly going back to the 60s. And it's, it really seems that we've taken a very dangerous turn here, that the places that should be the citadels of free speech are in many cases the places where there's less free speech than almost any other aspect of society. The modern American workplace gives them a close run for second for fear over litigation. But what do you ascribe this to culturally, not legally, but just culturally, just from having dealt with students over all these years?
Overall, I think colleges, universities still are the citadel of free speech. But there are highly publicized instances where speech is unfortunately being suppressed. Culturally, I think it's interesting. I think this is the first generation of college students to have grown up from a young age being taught that bullying is wrong. They've internalized the message. They want very much to protect their classmates from offense. Unfortunately, sometimes this takes the form of wanting to suppress speech they don't like.
Yeah, somebody floated out the notion we were interviewing on this topic a couple weeks ago about we have a generation that is growing up on proctored social media. And they're used to having some kind of, whether it's, you know, a filter or somehow a mechanism that's built into the software to censor comments that are posted online. And as a result, they're acclimated to having some kind of unseen authority figure establish the ground rules for conversation.
I think it's that. I also think that they may associate speech much more with things like yik yak and offensive chat sites than they do, as I would, with the civil rights protests of the 1960s or the anti-war protests. For the last couple of years, I've co-taught a class titled Free Speech on Campus. And in fact, I and the chancellor at UCI have a book coming out this summer titled Free Speech on Campus. And we've really seen in our students this laudable desire to protect their classmates from offense, but not recognizing the only way your speech or my free speech will be there is we protect the speech we don't like of others.
A couple of years back, it's quite a few years ago, it might be 8-10 years ago, there was a publishing company that published a new edition of Huck Finn, and they renamed the character N-Word Jim to drop the offensive appellation. And it became a news story because there were literary critics who were saying that this was a vandalism of work of art, et cetera, et cetera. And in covering that story, we used to be able to use the word, the N-word, not obviously as a pejorative, not to insult somebody, but as part of a discussion of public policy and the culture. The LA Times will still use it in print, but we will absolutely not use it on the air at KBC Radio and haven't for many, many years. And Dr. Laura, famously, when she was still on terrestrial radio, was criticizing people for the gratuitous use of the word and got vilified with advertiser boycotts for using the word to point out the offense of the word. So we're in this weird area now where even when adults are having a public policy conversation, the language is being restricted. And I find this to be disturbing because it is basically limiting our ability. I think what we're doing effectively is just putting the hoods back on the Klansmen. It's not making people change their views. It's just making them hide their views.
I think you combine two different things. I find it wrong to change the language of Mark Twain's book. That book was written, makes a point by using that language. On the other hand, from the time we were young, we were all taught there's certain things you don't say or do in public. You don't do things that are likely to offend people. I won't use the N-word in class because I don't want to offend my students unnecessarily. I don't use profanities because I don't want to offend people unnecessarily. That doesn't bother me because we've all been taught from the youngest age to refrain from doing certain things that are offensive to others.
Well, I would agree with you on a personal level that that to be sensitive. I mean, this is where I think we confuse political correctness with civility. I mean, it's one thing to be a civil person and to be conscious of what your impact is on the people around you. And it's another thing to face punitive measures if you like, for instance, the WFAN in New York City, Mike Francesa, who's a very famous sports personality in New York for many years, is in hot water because yesterday he referred to Asians as Orientals. And there's now people calling for him to be fired after 30 years on the air.
Do you know, when I was a kid, that's what we called ourselves. I was half Oriental.
There was Occidental and Oriental, and it's been declared. But you see, that's what we're in this bizarre time where people want to put, you know, heads on sticks for using language. And, you know, this isn't a legal issue. This is just a cultural issue. But I think that the Supreme Court the Supreme Court decision opens up this conversation. Erwin, can I pivot for a second onto one of these other issues? Because this one, of all these issues, could politically be a blockbuster decision, depending on how the court rules. And they're hearing a case on partisan gerrymandering. Of course, we know the history of gerrymandering, named after Elbridge Gerry from Massachusetts, former vice president of the United States way back in the day. And it's when congressional districts or election districts in general are drawn to favor a political party. And we know that the Republicans have a huge advantage in this area because the districts are drawn after the census is taken every 10 years. And if he who controls the state house usually has a great advantage when it comes to redistricting. And the Republicans have done very well in governor's races and around the country. And that helps partly explain why the map looks so red after Election Day.
This is a huge issue. And what's different now from what it was before is that computer programs are so sophisticated that they can gerrymander far more successfully than ever before. So the party that gets 51% of the seats in the legislature can redraw the maps to end up with 80% of the seats in future elections. It's supposed to be that voters choose their elected officials. It's now that elected officials get to choose their voters. And so I think it's great that the Supreme Court is taking up this case out of Wisconsin. I think that gerrymandering is a huge threat to the democratic process.
I agree. I mean, we see districts that look like strands of DNA. They have no logical place in geography. They're strung together literally to go pick up a vote here and a vote there. And of course, one of the ways that we make this easy for the politicians to do this is by not participating in the electoral process. When we have local elections and people sit them out, then with great specificity, the computer programs are able to figure out who's going to vote, who's likely to vote, and which way are they likely to vote.
And to be clear, both Democrats and Republicans do this when they control the state legislature, when they control the city council. In California, we got around that by the voters passing an initiative to create an independent commission to draw districts for the assembly and the state senate. Unfortunately, most states don't have that. And partisan gerrymandering is a real threat to democracy.
Yep, I agree. I think that this is a very important case. When are we likely to get a decision on this?
Early 2018 is my guess. The case will be argued next fall, probably in November and December. That then means you'll see a decision maybe March, April next year.
Right. So even if, let's say, a court were to rule that political gerrymandering is unconstitutional, it would be unlikely to impact the 2018 midterms.
I think that's right, because then there'd need to be litigation in each state where there's been gerrymandering as to whether it went on is extreme enough to violate the Constitution that have to be new maps drawn. But it really could affect the 2020 elections, or even more, the redrawing of election districts after the 2020 census.
Hey, as always, thank you so much. The book is called Against the Supreme Court, Professor Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of the School of Law at UC Irvine. PTSD Awareness Month has been observed in June. It's an opportunity to bring about greater awareness to offer support and to promote increased access to care and treatment. Experiencing psychological stress as part of a military life can be common, but the Real Warriors Campaign has resources that can help. To talk to us about this, retired Army Major Ed Polito. Good morning, Major Polito. How are you?
Well, good morning, and what a great day to be an American, and what a special day to be talking about a very important issue.
It is an important issue, and we have been using our military very hard for a very long period of time. We cannot emphasize enough that we have been engaged in the longest war in the nation's history, more than double the length of World War II, and really, there's no sign that this is going to let up. That's just the cycle that we happen to be in world history, and it takes a tremendous toll on the soldiers and their families.
Yeah, and I have to say that as well. But one of the things that I've learned, too, is that, you know, we take this oath and we defend this great nation. And as you stated, we've been in war for a long time. And what we can do as citizens of this great country is that we can provide support, healing, and recovery process for our wounded service members or those that live with the hidden wounds of war, and make sure that they're not left behind on the field of battle and that their families are supported when they come back. And so for us, the Real Warriors Campaign is about all of those principles and making sure that no one gets left behind on the field of battle.
There's a disturbing rate of suicide amongst veterans, and that's one of the many issues that Real Warriors deals with.
Exactly, and I will tell you that the Real Warriors Campaign, of course, through the Department of Defense, working with the VA, and then all the civilian communities, and you know what we're doing is we're making a difference. We're providing a safety net for our service members, veterans, and their families. And then by doing that, what we're doing is highlighting issues that our service members may be facing, whether it's hypervigilance to change in the way that they feel about themselves and about what has happened to them, to just psychological stress from being a service member, not necessarily deployed, but going through all of the training. That what we're trying to do is create a mental, physical, and wellness-supported entity where our military understands that, you know what, there's no stigma, go get help, but because at the end of the day, we need a well-trained force.
You know, it's funny, when I have a lot of friends that are in the military, my husband's actually in the military, but I have a lot of friends, and I've visited a lot of wounded warriors, and I know when they come home, you know, sometimes if they're, you know, say they have a stop off at Walter Reed or whatever, and they're sort of treated like rock stars, right? Everybody's there. We love you for your service. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And then they go home to whatever small town America they go to, and it sort of wears off after a while, and then they sort of fall into this depression. Like, how do guys like that, I know with social media it's a lot easier to sort of reach out, but how do we help those veterans that might fall in between the cracks when they go back home and, you know, everybody has to go about their own lives?
Well, and thank you for your service and sacrifice. And the way I would answer that is that we at the Real Warriors have this campaign website, realwarriors.net. People can call 24/7. Our outreach center, our consultants are there to support and provide that that needed resource. They can call 866-966-1020. And basically, you know, like I said, go to realwarriors.net and learn about our video profiles. That's a good way to learn about what we've got going on. Our PSAs, we've got articles, we've got social media. And then the way I would look at it, too, is we have to help our families. And I have a 16-year-old that has just been through all of these processes with our family. And after losing a leg and getting hit by a roadside bomb and living with PTSD, and I say PTSD, but I don't say it in a negative way. I try to say it in a positive way, that at the end of the day, that our family understands that, you know what, we've all got to be part of the game. We've all got to be part of the mission. And more importantly, we've got to let the general public know that recovery is possible. And there's folks like you that truly are our message board to make that happen.
Amen.
We're talking with retired Army Major Ed Polito. And again, the website is realwarriors.net, realwarriors.net. How can the public help?
Well, the public can go and basically go to the website, learn more about it. Also, as was stated, what can you do in your local community? Well, I agree. You get this welcome home, and then what happens when you come back? Well, the thing about it is, let's connect to our warriors. Let's make sure that they are part of our civic-minded opportunities that we may have. Let's understand that, you know, PTSD Awareness Month is not just about awareness. It is about action and making sure that in our communities, everyone understands these stressors. Everyone understands how they can help. And the Real Warriors campaign can be a guiding light for making sure that people understand what this campaign and what they can do to make a difference.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about it. And thanks for your efforts on behalf of, you know, the Real Warriors who need that need our help.
All right. Real Warriors, real battles, real strength. Hoorah.
So California's system for funding public education has pumped tens of billions of dollars, of extra dollars, into struggling schools. In a very interesting report in the Orange County Register, a CalMatters analysis of the biggest districts with the greatest cluster of needy children found limited success, we're being generous there, after spending all this money. So let's find out about this. The education reporter at CalMatters, it's a pleasure to welcome to the show Jessica Calafatti. Jessica, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me on this morning.
I appreciate it. So I remember quite a few years ago when Jack O'Connell was the superintendent of public instruction for the state of California. We had him on the show, and I asked him a theoretical question that if he had, could go to bed and wake up and have every penny that he could dream of for public instruction from kindergarten through, you know, PhD, what would California need to do it right? And it totally stumped him. And I asked him, I said, is the answer more? Is that just the answer? Just give us more? Because we have been incredibly generous in the state of California, in the city of Los Angeles and Orange County as well, when it comes to public instruction. People have consistently voted for bond measures, for funding for schools, and yet we don't seem to get a lot of bang for the buck.
So I think the thing to note here to start off is that California does spend less per pupil on public education than most other states. That's to do with Prop 13. We can't raise money at the local level the same way many other states can. So that's why the money that we get from the state is so important. And this money that we focused on in our report on the state's new school funding system was really important and still has an opportunity to be transformative because it's a huge infusion of cash for districts that have concentrations of disadvantaged kids. And what we mean by disadvantaged kids is low-income students. We're talking about foster youth, and we're talking about kids who are learning how to speak English. So just inherent, those problems mean that those districts need extra money to help those kids overcome those challenges. Maybe the English learners need an extra tutor. Maybe the low-income kids need, you know, more school supplies that they're not getting at home. Who knows? The point is there's not disagreement that those students deserve and need extra money to succeed in the classroom. What we tried to figure out with this analysis was how much extra money had districts gotten over these 4 years that the state has pumped extra money into them, and what did they spend it on, and then what did they achieve? And the first two questions became, you know, almost impossible to answer in many cases, which is a big problem. We don't know in most cases where this money is going.
You know, we did the story earlier today that the LAUSD, Los Angeles Unified School District, which is obviously the second largest school district in the country, just approved their budget of $7.5 billion. But it also includes layoffs of over 100 employees, mostly library aides. And at the same time that this is happening, the growth of administrators within LAUSD has been exponential. And this is why it's a head scratcher, because, you know, the entire city of Los Angeles, cops, firefighters, road maintenance, health inspectors, everything that the city of L.A. does, the budget is about $8 billion. LAUSD has lost almost 200,000 students in enrollment over the last decade, and the budget is almost dollar for dollar the same as the rest of the city of Los Angeles. It just, you know, from an outsider's perspective, it doesn't seem like we have a revenue problem. We have a way the revenue was allocated problem.
Yeah, I mean, it depends who you ask. Schools are going to point to those comparisons between California and other states and say, we get less per pupil. We've always gotten less, and it's not fair. And then you talk to an average taxpayer or observer, and you look at numbers like what you just mentioned. Why is the district spending so much more on administrators and cutting library aides? You know, an average parent could say, do you want an extra secretary or do you want an extra library aide? I think they're going to say, let's have an extra library aide. But it's more complicated than that. It's not just let's look at our resources and look at our needs and match one up to the other. There's, union contracts to contend with. You can't just fire some people. It becomes very complicated, and that's why these issues are so tough to solve, because you'd like to think that it's all about the students and what's best for them, but there are some inherent impediments to even using the money that districts receive in the best manner for the kids.
Well, and there's also a lot of propaganda put out on this in the sense that, for instance, you know, in California, they'll say that, well, we're in the bottom of the pack when it comes to per pupil spending. But it depends, mm-hmm. again, on how you look at the numbers. One of the ways they arrive at that figure is by taking off the books bond money. And we spent mm-hmm. billions, I mean billions, on school construction. So Cal Watchdog says we spend $30,000 a year, essentially, in LAUSD per student. So a class of 25 would be $750,000 for one class. It's an enormous amount of money when you look at what the rate of return has been.
That's another area where the inputs and the outputs don't quite match up, because there are some school facilities in LA and in other districts across the state that are literally crumbling around students and need to be replaced. There should be no question about it. And then there are other cases where, you know, new school facilities are being built that some would argue are too lavish, and, you know, they have this beautiful atrium
We built a $500 million high school in downtown L.A. We built a $500 million high school. And there's just no evidence whatsoever that this actually increases test scores or performance or graduation rates or success later on in life. And that's why we keep coming back to we've added exponentially, as I mentioned before, the number of administrators in LAUSD. So, you know, rather than fixate on the actual number of dollars put into the system, what's perpetually missing is how is the money spent? Why is all of these billions? If we can run everything that LA does for essentially what it costs to run just the schools, you have to ask, why are teachers having to buy supplies out of pocket? I mean, why is that happening? And we ask that question year after year after year, and we just get this. We still get stories from teachers saying that they're out of pockets for school supplies. You know, it's very frustrating. Hey, CalMatters.org, by the way, CalMatters.org. Jessica, thanks for coming on and talking to us about it. Appreciate it. The OC Register, the piece is there. You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
On the next Frosty, Heidi, and Frank.
An all-new live Frosty, Heidi, and Frank show coming up on Monday at 6 a.m. But if you can't listen live, don't worry. You can catch up on the show every day by becoming a VIP at FHFshow.com or downloading the FHF app in the App Store or on Android. Access over 17,000 hours of commercial-free audio and video on demand right to your device, or watch the show's live webcast every morning as it's happening. VIPs of FHFshow.com also get exclusive offers and discounts to all things Frosty, Heidi, and Frank. FHFshow.com or download the FHF app for free.
Frosty, Heidi, and Frank. Weekday mornings, 5:30 to 9:30 on the Rock of Southern California, 95.5 KLOS.
Hi, can I have 2 steak tacos?
Flour or corn?
Oh, no tortillas. And no steak. Also add turkey, lettuce, and tomato. And just put it between 2 slices of bread.
You know this is a taco truck, right?
As a small business owner, you've got enough to deal with. Let the experts at Progressive insure your business so you can focus on whatever that was. With over 30 commercial, auto, and business coverage options, we'll build a plan that's right for you.
Oh, I'll have Swiss on that, too. Thank you.
Visit ProgressiveCommercial.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Do you hear that racket? That is the sound of 7 scientists at ExxonMobil thinking, working. Listen. They're discovering the precise combination of 7 key ingredients in Synergy gasoline that helps you get better gas mileage. These science folks sure know how to party.
Shh.
Sorry. Synergy gasoline from Exxon and Mobil. Energy lives here.
Fuel economy claims are compared with gasoline meeting minimum government standards. Results will vary. Visit Exxon.com or Mobil.com for details.
Hi, this is Bo Bachman from Galpin Ford. Last year's summer sales event was the Galpin 10,000. Well, this year's sale goes to 11. It's one louder. The Galpin 11,000. It's an ambitious goal to sell 11,000 vehicles this summer. So we know we need to make incredible deals on the largest inventory of new Fords in America. Here's just one example. Lease a brand new 2017 Ford Focus SE for just $169 per month plus tax. In addition, get 0% APR financing for 60 months on many new Fords, and only at Galpin Ford. Included with a purchase or lease of any new Ford, receive oil and filter changes for 2 years. Please join us during the Galpin 11,000 sale. It's one Lauda. Going on now.
Call 1-800-GO-GALPIN or visit Galpin.com. Along with MSRP of $21,040, $29.99 cash and trade equity plus $37.50 factory rebate for a total of $67.49 plus government fees and taxes due at the signing. On approved credit, no security deposit required. $31,500 total miles of 20 cents per excess mile. $16.67 per thousand borrowed. Down payment valve varies based on credit approval. Max of 4 oil changes. Sale ends 6/30/2017.
Using Groupon, people can save up to a gazillion dollars a week. Not each of them, of course, but all of them combined. In reality, you can save up to $100 a week on what you do every day. Getting a haircut? Check Groupon. Need an oil change? Check Groupon. Now, we are in no way implying that you could save a gazillion dollars a week on nearby yoga classes, golfing, Italian restaurants, or resorts. However, use the top-rated Groupon app and save up to $100 a week on what you do every day. Download the app and save. Groupon.
Allergy sufferers are hearing a lot of numbers these days about symptoms and relief. But the number sufferers want most is zero, as in zero nasal allergy symptoms. And nothing gets you closer to zero than Nasacort. Because unlike antihistamines that stop only one cause of your allergy symptoms, Nasacort stops more. And stopping more gets you closer to zero. For 24-hour relief of your worst nasal allergy symptoms, including congestion, choose Nasacort. It stops more of what makes you miserable. Use as directed.
Here, try my barbecue bacon cheeseburger or chicken sandwich with sweet or spicy barbecue sauce topped with bacon and onion rings.
You're the best, Jack!
No, you're the best.
Oh, Jack!
Only a Jack in the Box. Limited time only at participating restaurants.
Lowe's has you covered for all those projects on your summer to-do list and will even help you save. Update your old flooring with stylish new ceramic tile starting at just 49 cents. And give your home a whole new look inside and out with $10 to $40 off paint, exterior stains, and resurfacers via rebate. All projects have a starting point. Start with Lowe's. Paint offer valid 6/21 through 6/28. Exclusions apply. Tile offer valid 6/21 through 7/5. Price based per square foot or per piece based on market. While supplies last, U.S. only.
It's been called shell shock, war neurosis, and battle fatigue. Today, we call it post-traumatic stress disorder, and it affects 1 out of every 5 warriors returning from battle in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Wounded Warrior Project offers comfort and support for warriors with PTSD and all other scars of war, whether those scars are visible or hidden. Find out how to help, because for warriors, the greatest casualty is being forgotten. Please visit WoundedWarriorProject.org.
95.5 KLOS. Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
We start with a very important story, one that we've touched on many times as many different studies have come out, many different aspects of this story. But this is from Bankrate.com. It's a survey that talks about how we are handling our money as individuals. Of course, we don't handle our money very well as a nation, as a state, as a county, or as a city. So I don't know. You know, there's just a lot of us in those jobs, too. But there are five specific points made here that talk about how we are struggling financially. And to talk to us about it right now is the chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com, Greg McBride. Greg, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is such an important topic because, you know, we can get into all of these big issues, but a lot of stress in people's lives comes from, of course, mistakes and decisions that we make. It's not, you know, politics. It's not Washington. It's just stuff we decide to do or don't decide to do. And some of it is outside our control, and some of it is very much in our control. But the numbers here, we start with the numbers. 1 in 4 literally have no emergency savings of any kind, not even a dollar.
Yeah, and that was the subject of a recent survey that we had done. We take a look regularly at emergency savings, and 24% have no emergency savings at all. That's actually the lowest it's been in about 6 years. We actually have seen a little bit of progress. The numbers have actually been worse over the past several years. People are slowly making a little progress, but still fewer than a third of Americans actually have an adequate emergency savings cushion, enough to cover 6 months' worth of expenses. But, you know, we're seeing that number nudge higher. People realize how important it is. I think a lot of people, they just haven't prioritized it high enough. And they've been hemmed in by high household expenses and stagnant incomes. Those are the top reasons consumers give us for why they're not spending more and why they're not saving more.
Yes, and it's, again, when you look for $500 in savings, the number goes to 60%. 60% of Americans could not handle an emergency bill of $500, which is very easy to encounter in life. You know, something goes wrong with the car, there's your $500 bill. It's very simple. So that's one point. The next one is that, and this is less forgivable, and this is the easier one to correct, is how we prioritize our spending. And that you found that 36% of Americans are more concerned about how they pay for their next vacation than about saving for retirement.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't our survey, but yeah, I've seen those numbers, and, you know, that's unfortunately not surprising. People put a lot more time and effort into planning vacation than they do learning about their retirement savings plans. And, you know, I conduct 401k seminars, and I can tell you from the attendance or lack thereof, people definitely not prioritizing that one enough, but they'll spend a whole lot of time, you know, keeping their social media up to date.
Well, you know, look, the reality, we're dealing with the fun factor here. There's just nothing. I mean, saving for retirement is the responsible thing to do.
Who knows if you're going to make it that long?
That's exactly right. That's it.
Gotta have your fun now.
Well, if you don't save, you won't make it to retirement. That's pretty much guaranteed. So if you want to retire, you have to save.
It's very hard to convince a 20-something that retirement even exists.
I actually have better luck with the 20-somethings. We actually see a lot of positive signs from millennials in terms of emergency savings and retirement savings. So the inclination to save, I've been pleasantly surprised by the figures we get regarding millennials in that regard. My only beef there is with regard to retirement savings, today's young adults are investing way too conservatively. They're hunkering down in cash. We've actually found that millennials have the highest preference for cash as a long-term investment, you know, relative to any other age group, and it really should be the least preference for cash on a long-term investment horizon. Okay.
Is that because they simply don't trust the financial institutions?
Yeah, and financial markets in general. I think that's coming of age in the financial crisis, and that being during their financially formative years absolutely made a big impact.
Yeah, I can understand that. We are talking with Greg McBride, who's the chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com. Let's get to number three. Millions of us hide money from our spouses and partners. This is fascinating. Why do people do that? I've my theories. Did you ask that question?
Well, I mean, this is a survey that was actually done by our sister company, creditcards.com. And, you know, I think a lot of this is, people that are incurring debt, spending, overspending, and, you know, that's really the root of a lot of that secrecy. And then also the other end of the spectrum, it's people that have managed to squirrel away money that they don't want their spouse or partner to squirrel away on spending. So, you know, it tends to be, the opposites of one person's a spender, the other one's a saver, that seems to be at the root of a lot of that secrecy.
Leanne asked an interesting question about this. Also, as an addendum to this, is people who not just hide money from their partners, but people who hide debt from their partners.
Yeah, I think the two are related. The saver is going to hide their savings, and you know, the person who has debt doesn't want the other one to know about the debt they've racked up. So, I think those two, you know, almost go hand in hand.
We prioritize paying the wrong bills first. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, you know, this was one that, you know, during the financial crisis, it kind of really sort of threw the common sentiment on its ear, in that, you know, people used to pay the mortgage first and the car payment a close second. And, you know, the other unsecured debts would just, you know, they'd get paid later if they got paid at all when money was really tight. And then what we saw during the recession was the mortgage wasn't first. In often cases, the mortgage was last to get paid. The first bill people paid, their cell phone.
Yep.
And, you know, and a lot of times credit cards got paid simply because that's what people were using to buy groceries, to put gas in the car, just to kind of function day to day, financially speaking, whenever they were out of work or when their hours had been significantly cut back.
Now, is it possible, and I know a lot of folks look at their cell phone and their car as their lifeline. They can't get to work. They can't work without it. So it's not necessarily just an indulgence to have a cell phone. For a lot of people, that is their work now.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's, people respond to incentives. And, you know, the incentive that a lot of people were faced then was, you know, if they stopped paying the mortgage, it was going to take 2 years to get them out of the house anyway. But, you know, if they stopped paying that phone bill, you know, they weren't going to be able to, you know, make the calls they needed to for work or to find work. If the car got repossessed, they weren't going to be able to get to work. You know, those were the things that you know, people needed to, you know, function day to day. And so that was really at the root of that reprioritization that many households undertook. It was, you know, really because, you know, they had been sort of backed into that corner when their income went away, their savings got absorbed, and they had to start satisfying what gets paid and what doesn't.
Greg, this last one is amazing. We have $1 trillion in credit card debt, but we also have $1 trillion in student loan debt, and we also have $1 trillion in car loan debt. So really, Americans are carrying $3 trillion of debt in some cases, because there's many, many millions of people who have got all three of these.
Yeah, I mean, and that doesn't even count the $8 trillion in mortgage debt. So, those debt burdens have been growing, too. I mean, in the first several years of the economic recovery, people were deleveraging. They were paying off the credit cards. They were getting out of debt. And then what we've seen over the past couple of years is really a reversal of that. Some of that is a function of lower unemployment, people back to work. So now they can get that car, that purchase they'd put off for a few years. But that means, you know, taking on a $500 a month car payment, and all of a sudden, you know, your debt burden is a lot higher than it was. So we see a lot of evidence of that on all three fronts. Credit cards, you know, of course, student loans, which, you know, that gets a lot of attention. You know, but car loans as well, all three of them over that $1 trillion mark in aggregate.
Now, one of the things that we talked about earlier this morning, we're discussing this topic, is how the schools, with rare exception, don't mandate classes on personal finance. And I, for the life of me, don't understand. We didn't do it when I was in school either. Randy says that they taught him how to balance a checkbook. At least there was a class that taught that, which is a step in the right direction. But I really don't understand why financial literacy isn't a mandatory class in schools. And I really do believe, I mean, I made it half joking, but When you look at how, for instance, we finance the state of California, the city of Los Angeles, you really, and what's going on in Washington, where we have a budget deficit that is a national debt that's, and you need an astronomer to figure out what that number really is. It's so enormous. And you have to wonder whether or not we're not suffering from a national, a pandemic of innumeracy, is, I guess, the official term for mathematical illiteracy.
No, I have no doubt. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, when I was in high school, you know, no personal finance. I had to take 4 years of English and literature, 3 years of history, and only one semester of driver ed. So all of that's backwards, if you ask me. But, look, and the demand is there. I've lectured on personal finance on college campuses, and the classes are oversubscribed. People need it. People know they need it. And people want it. Why the bureaucracy cannot cave into that and deliver that. And the younger we start educating people about that, the better. You know, why the bureaucracy can't get that fixed is beyond me. But, you know, the need, the demand, and the desire are all definitely there.
Well, it's an important topic. We all know that money comes out of the machine and the bank wall. What we don't know is how the money gets into the machine. And we got to start focusing on that. We are really facing a crisis as the baby boomers are already hitting retirement age. But as millions of us start to get into that that red zone, and people are not prepared for it. They're just simply not prepared for it. And this is going to be a social catastrophe as the country gets older and people have less and less resources. This is the burden that's going to be placed on the next generation, the working generation, because, you know, Social Security is inherently a transfer payment. It's all based upon it's predicated upon the assumption that the next generation will pay for the previous generation. But when the burden gets too high and the working generation says enough, we're not paying anymore, there's going to be hell to pay.
Well, there just aren't enough workers relative to the retirees. I mean, it's, that ratio is out of whack. And you know, Social Security is just a fraction of the problem. You know, Medicare's got an unfunded deficit that's like seven times that of Social Security. People are woefully undersaved for retirement. We've seen a little bit of progress on emergency savings, but, you know, it's still – you know, got a long way to go there. So, you know, I think one thing that has changed that I've noticed a change over the last decade relative to, you know, the decades prior to that, people realize how important savings is. They know they have to do it themselves. Nobody's going to do it for them. It's just that, boy, that needle, it just hasn't moved very much. People have had a real difficult time making headway on both retirement savings and emergency savings.
All right. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. And Greg McBride, appreciate you coming on the show with us as always. As we told you late last week, actually the story broke, I think, on Friday, that Jeff Bezos and Amazon gobbled up Whole Foods for $13.7 billion. Some wag posted online. I thought this was pretty funny. The dialogue following dialogue. Steve Bezos saying, "Alexa, buy something from Whole Foods." And Alexa says, "Buying Whole Foods."
Exactly.
And Bezos goes, "No!"
And here I thought an avocado at Whole Foods cost $13
billion. $13.7
billion.
Close. This is obviously a move that Amazon is making to respond and to up the ante on Walmart. But what does it do to the entire grocery industry, which already works on thin margins? We turn, as we always do, to the consultants of the retail industry, president of Davidowitz & Associates, Howard Davidowitz. Howard, how are you?
Good morning. Just fine.
Thanks for being here, Howard. So have I got this right? This is the battle between Walmart and Amazon for the home grocery delivery services.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of other people's in the battle, like Kroger, that does well over $100 billion. They're the largest traditional grocer in the United States, Target. There's a number of people in the battle. But clearly, Walmart and Amazon are the two main contestants.
Now, what does this do to the – I mean, when you look at the Ralphs or the, the Safeways and all these other grocery stores that are around here, the Gelson's, the
– Pavilions.
The Pavilions. There's so many of them, Vaughn's. What does this do to those companies?
I think those companies are under gigantic stress, but not mainly from this. I think if you look at those companies, the stress they're under are going to be from Aldi Food, from Lidl coming to the United States, from Walmart getting its food act together, improving its assortment, getting its prices down, Kroger investing in price, getting their prices down, and, of course, now Whole Food and Amazon will get their prices down. So if you're a leverage company, and a lot of these are, and you're in the food business, watch out below, you'll have bankruptcies in the food business. It's that simple. They won't be able to keep up. They won't be able to do the delivery. They won't be able to do the pickup. They won't be able to do it well enough, and they'll go. So there'll be more consolidation, and there'll be fewer companies. That's what I look for in food.
Now, Howard, what kind of – because, you know – consumer trends, consumer tastes change. I mean, that's not, you know, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know this. People's tastes change over time. And one of the societal changes that we've commented on is a lot of people don't cook anymore. They don't cook at home. They eat standing up. They eat breakfast wraps. They're eating off of food trucks. And this has got to be impacting the grocery chains, because even though you'll still see people go to Costco or something like that and buy, you know, 55-gallon drums of cocktail olives, but the bottom line is that family patterns of family meals have changed dramatically.
If you take the trend you just mentioned, which is a very important one, and say, what did the food business do about it? I'll tell you what they did. They've tremendously expanded their offering of prepared food. That's what they did. So you go into a food store and you can buy dinner, and all you got to do is warm it up quickly and you have a good dinner. Veal Parmesan, all kinds of stuff. So soups and everything, pizza.
Whole chickens.
Chickens, right. So if you look at what the food business did, they've responded to the trend that you just pointed out, which is absolutely right. That's what they did. They got into the prepared food business in a huge way, and they're doing lots of business.
So now that Walmart bought Whole Foods, I mean, everybody knows that the joke about Whole Foods is they called it Whole Paycheck. It's an expensive place. It's an upscale market. So what message are they sending that they bought that company as opposed to a lower cost company? Are they?
Well, what happened? You got to understand what happened to Whole Foods was, it's a great company, terrific. But what happened is everybody got into the organics business. I mean, Kroger became a terrific, you know, organics retailer. Trader Joe's. I mean, there's a lot of terrific organic people out there now. And when Whole Foods got into business, they had all the market share in organics, and people caught up to them, and people underpriced them, and blah, 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 and they ended up where they ended up. So that's one of the things that happened, and that's what happens in a retail business. You got to keep reinventing yourself. As far as Amazon goes, I think this is a brilliant acquisition because the food business is less penetrated by online than almost anything, and it's a gigantic business. The challenge will be, will people buy produce online? That's the challenge. I'm not sure. They might, but so far they're not. Are they buying meat online? No. Are they buying produce online? No. They want to squeeze the oranges and the grapefruits and all of this business. So
I did it for a little while when I was pregnant and I had it delivered to me, Amazon Fresh. But then I went back to the store.
Well, yeah, you're right. Look, this is becoming a delivery business. Who is the greatest deliverer in history of the world? Amazon.
Yeah.
And Amazon, this will enhance Amazon Prime. They're going into wealthy areas where Whole Foods build stores. They've got a gigantic – Amazon is doing more online food business, even though they're a midget in food, than anyone else. And they're a midget. It's amazing. So I expect this to be a winner. For Amazon, they're going to deliver very quickly. They're going to get they're going to make the prices much more competitive in Whole Foods. There's no doubt they always do that. They're a market share company. They go for market share. They offer great prices. They'll do it. And I just think it's a great – if you're taking on Walmart, 56% of Walmart's entire business is food and consumables. 56%. Wow. 5-6, said it did a largest food retail in America by far, by far. So they're taking Walmart on in the heart of Walmart's business. And I think they're going to do very nicely.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see how the other chains survive. I mean, to me, I don't pay much attention. Of course, I don't spend a great deal of time. I'm the husband, so I'm the guy that is sent to the grocery store to pick up the thing because I'm close. And then, I inevitably forget what it is. I come back with six things except for the thing that she sent me to get.
I understand it totally.
So I'm the wrong guy to, but I would still suspect that most people want to shop in a market close to their home,
yes.
Period.
Yeah.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. You put your finger on it. The drugstore business and the food business are both convenience businesses. You're absolutely right. Convenience is a critical part of food. Not as important as drug, but very important. So the food business is a convenience business.
Yeah.
But the world is changing. Look, would you have ever dreamed that the fastest growing area in online would be apparel?
No.
I wouldn't have either. So what's happening is amazing. We're in a new world. Everything is changing, and no one has handled change in history better than Jeff Bezos. No one.
Well,
he is the greatest change manager I've ever seen, and I think he's going to master food and kick Walmart's butt, and I think this is a good start.
Well, it's going to be interesting. We'll follow it. Thanks, as always, Howard. Always appreciated. Davidowitz & Associates, Howard Davidowitz, consultant to the retail industry. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.